This evening's talk is going to be, I thought, on dependent origination. Yeah. So I hope this not sounds too ambitious to you, because dependent origination is a very profound teaching in many ways. For that reason, it may sound maybe a bit fear-inducing sometimes. And for those of you who have known Buddhism for a long time, you may find it quite interesting to hear something about dependent origination. For those of you who haven't heard about this teaching, I'm going to try to teach it in such a way that it becomes meaningful and becomes fairly easily comprehensible. I'm not going to go into all the details and all the profundities, but because it is such an important teaching, an important part of the Buddha's explanation of the world, of reality, of everything, I think it's very useful to have some idea what this dependent origination is all about and how it actually works. So that's why I want to do this. You read the suttas and you see what the Buddha said, you see his teachings, and again you come across this teaching of dependent origination. So obviously it is very important. It's a very important part of the way the Buddha explained things. So first of all, I'm just going to go very briefly through these so-called 12 factors of dependent origination, to give you some idea and kind of overall picture what this is all about. And then, having gone through the 12 factors, I'm going to explain just some of the most important aspects of dependent origination in detail. I'm not going to explain the whole thing in detail, just those aspects that seem important to me. And then I will also try to integrate it into the rest of the Buddha's teachings and show you why this is so important, why it matters that we understand this. In other words, I want to make it practical. I want to make it something that we might be able to use in our daily lives. So first of all, I'm just going to go through the 12 factors of dependent origination fairly briefly. And then you don't have to remember these things. I'm just doing it to give you a framework, a kind of reference point as we go through these things afterwards. So the first of these factors is usually known as ignorance. Ignorance means not understanding reality as it actually is. It's a kind of distortion of our understanding, not seeing things clearly. And once there is ignorance in a being, whether it's a human being or any other being, once that is there, there is the making of karma. We create karma through our actions. And that karma, of course, leads to results in the future which are either pleasant or unpleasant, depending on that karma. That's the second factor. And the results that it gives in the future are very often connected with rebirth. In other words, where we get born in the future life. So the third factor of dependent origination is consciousness. It's consciousness arising in a particular state. And with consciousness, you always have a body. You always have the mind. The other factors of the mind are always there with consciousness. So because of that, that becomes a fourth factor of dependent origination. It's mind together with body being conditioned by consciousness. The fifth factor, once you have mind and body, you have the six senses. The six senses are part and parcel of this thing we call the human being, mind and body. And once you have the six senses, you start to experience the world. The experiencing of the world happens through these six senses. So that is the sixth factor, known as contact usually. It's like we are contacting the world. We are experiencing the world. Now, an important part of that experience, a very fundamental part of it, is called feeling. This becomes the seventh factor of dependent origination. We experience the world usually either as something pleasant or as something unpleasant. And this can change very rapidly from moment to moment. One moment we have something pleasant that we experience, the next moment something unpleasant, and the moment after that something which is somewhere in between maybe. Then when because we experience things as pleasant and unpleasant, we have desires. We have desires because we want the pleasant states to last. We want to have those most of all. And we want the unpleasant things to disappear. We have a kind of aversion or negativity to the unpleasant things. So desire is a natural consequence of feeling. Once you have this desire or craving, which is the eighth factor, then you have which is called taking up or grasping or clinging sometimes. And this very often is like once you have desire, it's like you have strategies, you have ways to make sure that those desires get fulfilled in the best possible way. And these strategies, these are called taking up, clinging, grasping at things. Once we grasp at things, once we decide on a particular way of living our life, then again we make karma according to that grasping, according to that clinging. And once we make karma, once we live in that particular way, this is called existence, factor number 10, I think it is, then we have rebirth or jati as the 11th factor, because we get reborn according to that karma that we make. Once we get reborn, then we experience what everybody else in human life experiences. We experience aging, we experience death, and we experience all the sufferings of being a being, whether it's human, animal, or otherwise. So that, in brief, is what dependent origination means. The sequence of conditions, the sequence of 12 factors, each one building on the previous one. And the important thing here is to understand that there is a conditional relationship between all of these factors. And that's why it's called a dependent origination. The subsequent factor depends on the previous one. So, for example, to experience suffering, experience old age and death, first of all, you have to be born. Birth is a necessary condition for you to be able to experience suffering in life. So each one of these conditions, starting from ignorance at the very beginning, all the way to suffering at the very end, each one is necessary for the subsequent one to exist. And that is a very important fact in this dependent origination. That's the only thing you really need to keep in mind for this talk, because then the rest of the things should hopefully fall in place. Each condition is necessary for the subsequent one to exist. This is a causal relationship between these 12 links. So to get a grasp, get a feeling for what dependent origination is all about, I sometimes tell people that the best thing to do is to look at the end points of these 12 links. The end points are, first of all, ignorance at the very beginning, or misunderstanding of reality, if you like, and then suffering at the very end. These are the two end points, the first and the 12th factor of dependent origination. Because if we understand the end points, everything else becomes quite clear, because it is a condition sequence. So the last factor of dependent origination then is suffering. Now this is obviously very important, because this shows us the purpose of dependent origination. The purpose is found in the last factor. So the purpose is to show us basically why suffering comes about in the world. This is why we have this teaching of dependent origination, because it shows us the causal arising of suffering. This is the purpose, and that's why this is the last factor of this thing here. And of course, this becomes straight away very practical. You can see straight away why this is very practical, because if we understand why suffering arises in the world, then we have an opportunity to do something about it. If we understand the causal relationship, then we can do something with those causes, and we can both alleviate the suffering, lessen the problems that we have, and ultimately overcome, perhaps even overcome that suffering altogether. So this is why dependent origination is so interesting, because it shows us how suffering comes to arise in the world. And the interesting thing here is that the immediately previous condition before suffering, independent origination, is rebirth. It is birth which is the condition for suffering. So if we don't get born, basically we're not going to suffer. It is the very fact that we do get born into the world which gives rise to all these problems. And, of course, these two last factors, birth and then suffering. Suffering is sometimes also called aging and death, because these are the two most prominent and two most important factors of suffering. You will see that birth and death, these are also what is often a shorthand for this thing we know as samsara. Samsara is this perpetual wandering on, round and round, from one life to another one, from birth to death, from birth to death. So the last two factors here of dependent origination essentially are equivalent to this samsara, this eternal, perhaps not eternal, but certainly this very long-lasting wandering on from one life to another one, again and again and again. So this is another way of looking at dependent origination. It shows us how this thing we know as samsara comes to arise in the world, how there can be such a thing as samsara. Very briefly, samsara, the best way to look at samsara is not to look at it as kind of the universe out there, something different from us. Samsara is essentially how we as human beings experience the world. So it is your internal, what is goes on inside your head, that is samsara. How do you experience the world? So all the walk going around, if you could recollect your past lives, all the being reborn, all the getting old, all the dying, all the suffering, all the happiness, everything you do, all your experiences, this is essentially what samsara is all about. And samsara is, of course, ultimately equivalent again to suffering. Because all this wandering around, all this birth, dying, aging, being doing this, doing that, again and again and again, life after life, now being born here, now being born there, all that is essentially suffering according to the Buddha's teachings. So, in other words, what I'm saying is that dependent origination, it shows us how samsara and how suffering comes to be. It's extremely useful to know this, because then we can actually do something about it. So this is the end point of dependent origination, shows us what this is aiming at, what the purpose of this teaching is all about. But then we have the starting point of dependent origination. The starting point is usually translated as ignorance. Now this is very important, because once we understand the starting point, we understand how this whole dependent origination comes into being, how it can actually exist. If we were to remove the starting point, this whole dependent origination would unravel. It unravels because each factor of dependent origination is causally related to the previous one. So remove the first one, the whole thing unravels, and we essentially make an end of samsara. We make an end of suffering if we can remove this ignorance altogether. If maybe we are not able to remove ignorance altogether. Instead, we can maybe weaken ignorance. If you weaken ignorance, you weaken suffering. Because again, that weakening of ignorance makes itself felt all the way through that chain, all the way up to suffering. So you suffer less if you weaken ignorance. So for that reason, it's quite important to try to get a grasp of what this ignorance actually means. And ignorance is one way of translating this term, but as I was mentioning before, it is more about our distorted perception of the world. The problem is not so much that we lack knowledge, which ignorance might suggest. The problem is that we have a distorted understanding of how the world actually works. We don't see things as they actually are, and that is the problem. So maybe delusion is another way of translating this word, which is usually rendered ignorance, delusion, or misunderstanding, or distortion of reality. And this distortion basically comes back to the distortions that we talk about in Buddhism, when we tend to see things as happy, when in fact they are suffering. We tend to see things as permanent, when in fact they are impermanent. And we tend to see things as self when in fact they are non-self. This is the basic delusion that we live under. And this is the type of misunderstanding or ignorance which is at the root of this entire chain of dependent origination. Now one interesting fact about this ignorance at the beginning of dependent origination is that that itself is again conditioned by other things. Ignorance is not like a monolithic thing that stands there all by itself. It is also conditioned by other things in turn. And when we understand some of these conditions, we will very quickly understand what sort of practice we can undertake to undermine ignorance and eventually abandon it altogether. So what is the condition for ignorance? The condition for ignorance is the five hindrances. The five hindrances, I'm sure most of you would have heard of them. They are briefly the sensual desires in the world, through the any kind of desire that we experience through the five senses. They are ill will, irritation, anger. They are the sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry and doubt. These are the five hindrances. And these are the conditions for ignorance. So the stronger these five hindrances are in our minds, the more powerful this ignorance is going to be. How does this work? And I talked about this here before, but it's actually it's quite a useful way of looking at how the hindrances distort reality. It's quite simple to understand. If you are very angry, what happens in your mind? What happens in your mind if you're very angry is that you tend sometimes to do things that you otherwise would not do. You think that you should tell somebody off. You think that you should do something nasty because you're angry. And while you're angry, it seems right. This, I need to do this. This person deserves this. This will be for the good of that person if I tell them off. So that is what we often do. We do stupid things when we get upset at something. And, of course, once the anger is over, we realize that this was actually a mistake. We shouldn't have been so harsh at that person. We should have been more understanding. We should have understood why this person did this thing in the first place. It was a mistake. And then we feel a sense of regret and remorse that we did such a thing while we were angry. And this shows you the problem of anger. The problem is that when you're angry, your perception of the world is distorted. You don't see things as it actually is. And that is why we tend to do things that we later on regret. So you can see here how anger connects up with this thing we call ignorance. It distorts our understanding of the world. And desire is very much the same. If you think about desire, why do people have extramarital affairs, for example? Well, sometimes just desire overpowering the mind. You don't know what you're doing, and afterwards you regret it for a long, long time usually to come. Most people regret it. I've had people coming up to me and saying that they have regretted these things a lot afterwards. But again, it is desire in this case which distorts the perceptions. You think that you should do something which in reality you know that you should not be doing, when the mind is not overpowered by these desires. And it is the same if you go out shopping or you see something in a shop that you think you need and it looks so wonderful right there, this desire arises. And later on you realize it was a mistake to buy that item, because later on you are freed from that grasp of desire which arose in that moment. So the point I'm trying to make is simply that these five hindrances, in particularly anger and desire, they distort our view of the world. So the greater, the more of these five hindrances we have in the mind, the greater is our ignorance, the greater is this distortion of reality. The less we have of these five hindrances in our mind, the less is the distortion that we have, and the less is the ignorance. And it feeds into dependent origination all the way up to suffering. So the less hindrances we have, the less suffering we have. The more hindrances we have, the more suffering we have. It feeds through this whole chain because it is a causal chain going up. So the answer then, if you want to reduce ignorance, we want to reduce suffering in our lives, one way of looking at it is to say we have to reduce the defilements of the mind, in particular the five hindrances. How do we reduce the defilements of the mind? How do we reduce the hindrances? It is by practicing the Eightfold Path. That's really all there is to it. That is how you reduce these problems. By practicing the Eightfold Path, starting off with virtue. Now, if you are a virtuous person, there are certain things you cannot do. And because you can't do them, you're restraining yourself. You're restraining the hindrances. You're restraining the defilements. By practicing meditation practice, loving kindness, peace, all these beautiful states of mind, again, we are reducing the hindrances because we are going against the hindrances of the mind. We are taking them away, abandoning them step by step. So the Eightfold Path is nothing less than the removal of these hindrances or the removal of the defilements of the mind. So by this practice, we are reducing ignorance, and by this practice, we are also then reducing suffering. So there you can see very beautifully how the Noble Eightfold Path and how dependent origination, how it all fits together in a beautiful picture. And that is one of the wonderful aspects of the Buddha's teachings. One way of looking at it is that the Buddha's teaching is really a unified whole. It is one realization, one understanding. But it has all of these different aspects. And you can understand that one realization, like a big picture, and then each aspect is like one little piece of a jigsaw puzzle fitting into that big picture. And one, the more understanding you have of the Buddha's teachings, the more you understand how this jigsaw puzzle fits together. And what I pointed out right now is how the Noble Eightfold Path, or at least this is one way of understanding how the Noble Eightfold Path fits together with dependent origination. The Noble Eightfold Path reduces our ignorance stage by stage, therefore reduces our suffering until one day we can eliminate the suffering altogether. And how is it that reducing the hindrances lead to abandoning ignorance altogether? Well, by practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, stage by stage, reduce these five hindrances until the day comes, hopefully, for all of us, where those hindrances are completely abandoned. They're not there at all in the mind anymore. And this is what the Buddha promised. If we practice the Noble Eightfold Path properly, this is what will happen in the future at some stage. Now, when the five hindrances are completely abandoned, because they are the cause condition for ignorance, it means that ignorance has lost its conditioning. It has lost those things which prop it up, so to speak, because the five hindrances prop up ignorance. Ignorance is no longer propped up by the five hindrances, it becomes very weak at this particular point. And that is why after a very powerful and deep state of meditation, when these five hindrances are completely abandoned, that is why at this is the point when it is possible to attain that deep insight and understand the reality that the Buddha said is out there. The reality that there is suffering in this world, that there is things are impermanent, and ultimately that there is no permanent aspect inside the human beings. There is just non-self. There is no self in this universe. And that is what we see, when these five hindrances are completely abandoned. And that is why the deep meditations are so powerful. And that's why they are the last aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path. Because at that point, we have the possibility of breaking through to the actual truth that the Buddha said is there for us to understand. And at that point, when we break through that ignorance completely, we see reality as it actually is, in terms of the Four Noble Truths, if you like, in terms of the three characteristics, suffering, impermanence, and non-self, that when ignorance is completely abandoned, then suffering is also completely abandoned. They go hand in hand, because ignorance is the cause for that suffering. So this is how then to get a grasp on this dependent origination, to understand it is all rooted, the root of the problem is ignorance. That is the problem. The root is delusion, the misunderstanding of how things actually are. And it all leads, step by step, all the way up to suffering. We suffer because we are ignorant. Sometimes in the world you hear this saying, this proverb, that ignorance is bliss. Well, in Buddhism it isn't like that. In Buddhism, ignorance is suffering, and this is then the right way of looking at it from a Buddhist point of view. So we have to be careful with some of these worldly proverbs sometimes. So how is it then? This is the next thing to maybe consider a bit. How is it that ignorance translates itself into suffering? And this is also interesting because it shows us maybe the mechanism of dependent origination. This is what I will call maybe the core driver of dependent origination, how it actually functions, what actually drives this thing forward, why is it that ignorance leads to suffering? And to understand this, I'm not going to go through all the links of the chain, because I don't think that is actually necessary. What I'm going to do instead is just go through the last five of these links, because that shows us plenty enough how this thing actually works. And the seventh factor of dependent origination, the last six factors I should say, the seventh factor of dependent origination is, as I said before, it's feeling. Now feeling, I don't mean emotion by feeling. When the Buddha had used the word feeling, he meant how it is that we experience the world outside us in terms of either whether it's pleasant or whether it's unpleasant. Sometimes he also added neutral feelings, but they are really irrelevant and they tend to be experienced as either pleasant or unpleasant anyway. So really feeling is about whether we see the world, whether we experience pleasure or displeasure. And this is part and parcel of being a human being, of being an animal, of being any kind of being, that we have this kind of experience of the world. Always it is either pleasant or it's unpleasant. And this is part and parcel of having a mind, of having a body. The previous links of dependent origination just before feeling just shows us how it is that feeling arises from having a body and having a mind. That's why I have to skip them for this particular purpose. And of course, once it is given that we experience the world in times of pleasure or displeasure, it is also given that we are going to have desires according to those pleasures and displeasures. Because we don't want to have displeasure, and we want to have pleasure. This is just the nature of any kind of being. This is the way we want things to be. And because of that, craving is a natural consequence of feeling. Desire is a natural consequence of having these feelings. So craving comes into being because we have feelings. Now, once we have craving, we want to make sure that this craving gets satisfied. We don't want to crave and not satisfy the craving, because this craving not satisfying it is painful. So we want to satisfy this craving. Now, to be able to satisfy this craving, we start to take things up in the world. We grasp at things. We go into all these kind of strategies, these ways of leading our lives. We do various kind of things so as to enable us to satisfy the cravings. We get into relationships. We buy ourselves a house. We have a nice job somewhere. We undertake an education for ourselves. We have children. We have maybe a religion for ourselves. We become Buddhists. Why do we become Buddhists? Again, it is a strategy for helping us to try to find some happiness in the world, to increase the pleasure and decrease the displeasure of the world. So all of these things are strategies. They are like views, even political viewpoints that we have are strategies for finding happiness and not suffering. So all of these views, how we make strategies to enjoy ourselves, to have a good time, not a bad time, all of this is part of this ninth factor of dependent origination, which is called taking things up, grasping at things, clinging to things in life. This is what it's all about. The strategies to make sure that we can satisfy the cravings that we have, which are based on feelings in turn. Now, once we take up certain strategies, once we do certain things in the world, we have relationships, we have a house, that means we start to live in a certain way. We live in accordance with those strategies. Now, living in accordance with those strategies is like a type of existence. We exist in a certain way. And most people, they live in the world of sensual pleasures. They have a nice house, because it satisfies their sensual cravings. They can have a nice breakfast in there, have nice meals with the family. They can have entertainment. They can feel safe from the world around them inside the little house. Then they have relationships. Again, it is to satisfy our desires for companionship and again also for sensual pleasures. And they have a job. Again, is to satisfy all the things that we need, that we can purchase through money. Again, that's why we have a job, at the very least, to enable us to survive. So this is the world for most people, just to be able to lead a life of as much pleasure, sensual pleasure, as possible. Now, if you're a Buddhist, you have maybe your priorities are a little bit different, so maybe you meditate, and then your strategy is to use meditation and a spiritual life to achieve that happiness. And in this case, Again, sensual pleasures may be part of it, but also, in this case, it's also the pleasures of the mind that we're also seeking to a higher extent, to a greater extent. And the more, the deeper we get into the practice of meditation, the more we are enjoying the pleasures of the mind rather than the pleasures of the senses. And this is another way of existing. It's an existence which is based on the pleasures of the mind rather than pleasures of the senses. So whatever we do in life, we are in a sense existing in a certain way according to the strategies that we undertake to find pleasure and displeasure in the world. We all want pleasures in a certain way, whether we call it peace, contentment, happiness, excitement, whatever it is, we all prefer pleasure to displeasure. So then, when we exist in this certain way, when we have a kind of established our consciousness in a certain way, that means that we are creating karma accordingly. Because we live in this way, we are creating karma accordingly. Consciousness is established in a particular field, if you like. If the field here is the kind of actions that we undertake, and because we make this karma, and because consciousness is established in this way, then in the future life, we get reborn in accordance to where that consciousness is established. We establish the consciousness in this life, and then when the body falls away, there the consciousness is straight away established in that particular state, because that is what we have been practicing over our lives. So if we incline towards practicing or just enjoying sensual pleasures our whole life, then that consciousness is established in sensual pleasures. When the body falls away, that consciousness will still be established in sensual pleasures. And we get reborn in a sensual realm according to that establishment. If you are a good meditator and our mind is quite peaceful, then after we die, at the moment we die, the consciousness is likely to be established in that peace. So when the body falls away, the consciousness will be right there with that peace. And we will be reborn in a realm in accordance to that peace. And this is how rebirth happens, in accordance with karma, in accordance with how the mind has been established in a previous life. So there you can see here, stage by stage, how this leads forwards. And then when rebirth happens in accordance to your karma, then whatever realm you're in, you will experience pleasure and suffering in accordance with that realm. And eventually you will become old. Eventually you will die in that realm, and the suffering that comes with this will also be part of it. So you can see here how this whole process works forward. Because we crave, we start have these strategies in the world. Because we have strategies, we live in a certain way. Because we live in a certain way, the consciousness gets established in that way, and we get reborn accordingly. And then we suffer in accordance, and have happiness in accordance with that rebirth. And it is all because of ignorance. Why is it because of ignorance? Well, the reason why we crave for feeling in the first place is because we think that we can control these feelings. If we didn't think that we can control them, we wouldn't crave for them. It is because we think that we can somehow have a habit the way we want, that is why we crave for these feelings. Imagine if you had absolutely no control of the feelings in your body, in your mind. What is the point of craving? There's no point of desiring anything anymore, because if you have no control, there's nothing you can do about it. There's absolutely, all you have to do is sit back and watch. And this is what happens when you eventually find out that the world is non-self, that there's no permanent core inside of you, that things are impermanent. When you see that, you realize that there is nothing you can do about the world. Feelings arise according to causes and conditions. You cannot control, ultimately, there is no control around these things. They just happen by themselves. And of course, at that moment, when you then abandon the ignorance, you abandon the delusion of a self, then you stop craving. Because you know that the world has to be the way it is. There is nothing you can do about it. You have seen through this idea that you can control the world. You can't control these feelings. When you realize that, you abandon craving. When you abandon craving, there's no more strategies to try to satisfy these cravings. When there's no more strategies, no more taking up of all kinds of strategies to satisfy the craving, there is no existence anymore according to those strategies. When consciousness is not established in anything in accordance with that existence, then when you die, when you pass away, the body disappears, then the consciousness is also not established in any particular realm. Because it isn't established in any particular realm, any particular, whether it's sensuality or meditation or whatever it is, there can be no rebirth because there's nowhere for that consciousness to go. It's not established anywhere. And then when there's no rebirth, there is no suffering, there's no old age, and there is no death anymore. And that is how the reverse comes out of this dependent origination, how we start off, and we can see how this whole thing can come to an end by abandoning suffering. Because when we by abandoning ignorance, when we abandon ignorance, craving has no longer a basis in our mind. So, that is, in brief, what I will call the engine inside dependent origination, the thing which drives this thing forward, the thing which makes sure that ignorance or delusion always leads to rebirth in the future. And how lack of that ignorance, lack of that delusion, makes absolutely sure that there can be no rebirth again in the future. But the important thing is also for us to remind ourselves that even if we feel that the goal of rebirth, of eliminating rebirth altogether, is far away, remember that every time you reduce ignorance a little bit, every time you reduce the hindrances a little bit, you're also reducing suffering for yourself, both in this life and in future lives. Because if you reduce the 5 hindrances, then your craving is not so strong anymore, because you realize that this is not going to, you tend to become wiser when these things are taken away. The craving is reduced. When the craving is reduced, again, it goes through the same sequence of conditions all the way up to suffering, and you have less suffering because of that. So, those are the two things, the aspects of dependent origination that I wanted to talk about. Maybe one last point which I wanted to mention is that sometimes you can read or you hear about people and they argue that they say, first of all, that, well, the Buddha's teaching is about interdependence, how everything in the world is interdependent. And I don't disagree with that. I certainly agree that things are very interdependent in this world. But then they say that this is shown by the teaching of dependent origination. Dependent origination shows us how all things are interdependent. But I, personally, I cannot see that that is quite to the point. Because to me, it seems that dependent origination is a very specific teaching about how ignorance gives rise to suffering in the world. It's a very specific sequence of conditions, and it shows us the mechanism by how these things come about. That is what dependent origination is about. If you want to find a Buddhist teaching, which teaches us about interdependence, I would say that is the teaching of non-self. Because as long as there is a self, as long as there is something which is outside of conditioned phenomena, something which is independent of everything else, then obviously that is not going to be part of this interdependent world of ours. It's going to stand outside, because not part of conditioned phenomena. But from the Buddhist point of view, because there is no such self, because there is nothing in this universe that is permanent, then everything becomes interdependent for that particular reason. So to my mind, it is this teaching of non-self which actually shows the interdependence of things more than anything else. Anyway, so that is my talk about dependent origination. Again, to summarize very briefly, to understand these teachings, think of the first factor and the last factor. The last factor shows us what dependent origination is aiming at. It is aiming at showing us how suffering comes to be. And the first factor shows us the most basic reason, the most basic cause, why this suffering comes about. And the most basic cause is our distorted understanding of how the world works. This is maybe The most important thing, I think, to understand about dependent origination, if you understand that, then I think you have a reasonable grasp of what this teaching is all about. Okay, that is all I have to say for this evening. Okay, so any questions or any complaints maybe? So you can, it's a complex teaching, so you're allowed to ask anything. You can ask very questions which are very foolish because you might not have understood what this was about. That's perfectly okay. So anybody have a question? Yes, sir. Well, this is the thing. In Buddhism, there is no fixed number of rebirths. It's not as if the universe is predetermined and it has to be a certain number of rebirths. It doesn't work like that. It all depends on your own practice. So the more powerful you practice the spiritual life and the Buddhist path, the fewer rebirths there will be in the future. It all depends on your practice. If you don't practice at all the spiritual life, then potentially you could get reborn forever into the future. There's no clear limit. The Buddha was once asked, will all the people of the world eventually attain liberation? Or is it only half the people in the world that will attain liberation? Or is it some other quantity? And the Buddha didn't answer that question because I don't think there is an answer to that particular question. So potentially, we could go on in samsara, suffering for a very, very, very long time if we don't practice the path fully, properly. Does that make sense? Yeah. Anybody else want to ask any questions, sir? Yeah. Right. Sure. Well, the thing is that you have to be very careful here, because to be able to understand how this works, you have to remember that the Buddha's teachings and dependent origination is about individuals and about how individuals experience the world. So on an individual level, if let's say that you are fully enlightened, you don't have any craving, what you do then is that you don't actually arouse any desire to end this particular thing. You don't have any strong craving, any strong urge to end this thing. If you can help, if the situation is there, you might help. But you don't have any thirst or craving inside of you to end these riots. So on a personal level, you are equanimous. Because you realize, ultimately, the world is the way it is. Sometimes there's going to be riots. Sometimes there's going to be earthquakes. Sometimes there might be atomic bombs. Sometimes there are going to be all kinds of disasters in the world. You can never solve all of those things. It's impossible. Ultimately, you're going to have to accept that this is the way the world is. If you can do something, fine, do something. But if you can't, you're going to have to look on equanimously if you want to have some peace in your life. Otherwise, you're going to be always agitated, trying to solve an endless, and it is literally endless, series of problems. So have compassion, but don't sort of allow it to make it too much suffering for yourself, because then it becomes pointless to have that compassion in the first place. So the point here is that the suffering here is you have to bring it back to an individual level, and it's at that individual level where you can understand the suffering, not at a societal level. At the individual level, it depends simply on whether you have ignorance or distortions in the mind. If you haven't got those, you're not going to suffer no matter what. If you have those, you are going to suffer no matter what. Does that answer your question?
I'm just wondering if the impact of some of the things that actually happen could be lessened if there's more dialogue when things are arising and things are going wrong. If the dialogue started earlier.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Buddhist leaders, for example, because obviously there's a lot of wisdom in Buddhism, and sometimes I think the leaders out there aren't really aware of it, and there's some dialogue between the management. Buddhism and the management and the government, there would be maybe less problems in the world.
Yeah. I think maybe you're right. I think it's certainly, if more of the Buddhist principles were, you know, used by governments around the world, it might actually be very helpful. I have no doubt about that. But the interesting thing is that, you know, you go to Thailand is a Buddhist country here, and many of the leaders in Thailand are Buddhists. You know, I think 95% of the Thai population is Buddhist. Most of the leaders are Buddhist. And still you have these problems. Go to Sri Lanka, you have a civil war going on. Now the man who is a president of Sri Lanka right now, he's a Buddhist. Right? Some of those generals who fight in the army are Buddhists. So the problem is that even though people are Buddhist and are supposed to enact some of these principles, very often human nature is such that it sort of overrules the principles of Buddhism, and it takes, you know, it sort of gets in the way for applying those principles. I think that is often the difficulty. The difficulty is that the world is so complicated, and when you get in a position of government, the pressures on you are so high from all kinds of directions. I think sometimes we need to have a bit more compassion on our leaders. I mean, if you look at the newspapers, we always criticize our leaders so enormously, no matter where they are and how they are. But sometimes we have to think, I think it's a very difficult position to be in the leadership of a country. How easy is it to be always be fair, always do the right thing? It is incredibly difficult because the forces on you are so, so strong. But ultimately, I agree with you. I think that maybe in Thailand, if they had a dialogue, it might be better. But maybe the circumstances are such that there's so much animosity that maybe a dialogue is difficult at this point. I don't know. I mean, you know, in principle, I agree with you, but I think the reality is often very, very complex and very difficult. I think the best thing you can do very often is that, at least for myself as a monk, I feel if I can give teachings which are useful for people, and hopefully, you know, those will sort of spread out in society and be used out there. And for other people, by all means, help out. Have compassion. Do something good. But be careful. Be very careful that wanting to do something in the world doesn't destroy your own peace of mind. Make sure it doesn't make you angry or upset at the world. Make sure you practice enough to have understanding and compassion, even for the leaders, even for the perpetrators of the crime, because ultimately they're all suffering, and they're all doing, if they do stupid things, it's because of delusion and because of misunderstanding, not because they want to be bad people. Nobody, I think it's fair to say, wants to be bad. So remember that, because it's very easy to become very self-righteous and then become angry and things. It's not going to help anybody, I think. Yeah.
Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavatang Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sanghang Namami